Hey, everybody, welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, where we help leaders go further, faster. I'm Andy Stanley, and I am excited about this month because my friend, author, and communicator, Clay Scroggins, is interviewing me on the topic of leadership and decision making. And here's why. As you may know, I recently published a book entitled Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. Five questions to help you determine your next move. And every time I teach this content, the consensus always is, I wish I'd heard that when I was in my 20s. I wish I'd heard that when I was beginning my career. I wish I'd heard that before I said I do. So I encourage you to pick up the book wherever books are sold. And if you have children living at home, you definitely need to pick up Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. And I'll tell you why. Because just as your personal decisions have impacted your children, trust me, their personal decisions will impact you. But as we're about to discover, these five questions are helpful in the context of organizational life as well. And that's why we're talking about it today. So Clay, welcome back to the studio. And speaking of children, how are your children?
Yeah, we have children, Andy. That is true. We have five kids and they're in virtual school right now. And it is going pretty well, honestly.
That's amazing. All five are in some sort of virtual
school. Well, the four oldest ones, our three-year-old is...
just in virtual.
Yeah, he's in La La Land. That's for sure. Hey, thank you for inviting me here. This is an honor for me to get to do this. I love this content and it's fantastic as leaders. It's so helpful. As you mentioned, it's so helpful at home. You know, at work, we make decisions every single day. Obviously, that's primarily what leaders do. Our futures, where we'll be someday, is being determined today as we make decisions.
Yep.
So this is such an important and a helpful topic. So I'd love to start with some background from you. When it comes to your decision-making approach, I would assume it has changed and evolved over the years. So as you think about your seat as an organizational leader, how has it changed? How has it evolved?
Well, that's a good starting question. I'm definitely a better listener than I used to be. I think early on, and I think this may be something young leaders all struggle with. I don't know. But early on, I confused leadership with decision-making. So I felt the pressure to appear to be the smartest and most informed person whenever we were in the process of making a decision, which is always a mistake because actually the goal is not to be the smartest or the most informed person in the room, but just the opposite. As we've quoted that great Jim Collins quote, he said, aspire to be the dumbest person in the room. And early on, I think I felt like I had to pretend to be the smartest person in the room and not only to be responsible for the decision being made, but to appear as if I was the one making the decision. Again, a complete mistake. Leadership isn't about making all the decisions. It's about making sure all the decisions get made and get made by the right people and get made by the right people in a timely manner. So if a leader will make sure the decisions that need to get made by the right people at the right time, things are going to go well, but that's different than feeling the pressure or the responsibility to make all the decisions. So it's about making sure that organization is equipped and staffed to make good decisions. In the book, I say your decisions determine the direction and quality of your life, and that's true personally, but organizationally, the same thing is true. Our organizational decisions, as you just talked about, our organizational decisions determine the direction and quality of our organization. So this is a really important topic, and one of the first lessons that I learned really the hard way was I should not make all the decisions, and I don't need to pretend to be smart enough to make them in the first place.
And I assume most leaders that struggle with that, they do so because their ego wants to be the one that knows it all?
You know, that's a great question. And for me, I think it was definitely ego in the sense, and this is understandable because when you're a young leader, which means you're generally surrounded by older people. And oftentimes you are responsible for people who are older than you. So there's some defensiveness, but there's also a sense of I've got to prove myself.
Right.
And it doesn't sound like I'm proving myself when I say, what do you think?
Right.
Or, well,
I don't know.
I don't
you
know.
Make that decision.
Yeah. What
right.
would you do? You've
right.
been doing this longer than me. That doesn't sound like a leader. That doesn't sound like I'm in charge. But in fact, that is the way forward. And the people in the room who are smarter than you, they know they're smarter than you. They know they're more experienced than you. And they actually, you gain influence with people when you're honest and when you lean into their expertise, regardless of where, you know, you sit on the organizational chart. So I think part of it is just one of those things you have to learn as a young leader, but I'm telling you, the earlier you learn it, the better off you are and the better decisions get made in the organization, even if you're not the one making them.
That's inspiring. And it's also freeing to know that you don't have to have
Yeah, it should answers. Be. Right.
So can you think of, as you think back on your own career, is there an example that you could share of a decision that you made as a young leader or even as a young adult that you wish you could go back and press the redo button on?
There are several I would not share publicly.
Share your most embarrassing
I'm going to wait just a little bit longer in my career before I share all of those. Yes, there are many that immediately come to mind. Most aren't all that interesting or have nothing to do with organizational leadership. But in general, you know, one of the questions that we talk about and I talk about in the book that anyone who's heard me teach for any amount of time is a question I come back to often is what is the wise thing to do? And one of the wise things that I wish I had done earlier was to lean more into my strengths and delegate my weaknesses. And again, this is just the typical, you know, leadership error of a young leader. You feel like you have to do everything to prove yourself and to prove to everybody you can do everything, but you can't do everything well. I held on to things, to responsibilities, and honestly, some decision-making environments that I should have let go earlier and have learned earlier to say, you decide, you decide, you decide, because saying you decide is not a lack of leadership. It's actually how you lead. It's by pushing the decisions as far down into the organization as possible. And we've talked about that before because, you know, the overarching principle is essentially that your fully developed and employed strengths will always add more value to the organization than your marginally improved weaknesses, because a weakness compared to your strength is always going to be a weakness, not compared to other people. But, you know, your fully developed and your fully employed strengths, it's just always a value add, a greater value add of the organization. And to fully develop and employ our strengths means we have to step back from some things and spend more time on others. And I look back and I just stayed in too many seats for too long in the early years. But I think I learned most of those lessons before we started this organization. So when we started 25 years ago, I had made enough of those mistakes to where I felt like we started off on the right track as it relates to those kind of young leader errors.
I think about that idea a lot because I've heard you talk about focusing, really maximizing your strengths as opposed to trying to get better at your weaknesses. My dominant hand is my right hand. And there are certain skills that I have or gifts that I have that feels just natural. I just can write. Yep. And I could spend time writing with my left hand and I could get better at it. But it just takes so much more intentionality and I have to think about it and really focus on it. So I love that simple concept of thinking about those areas of your life where you just write naturally and you don't even have to think about it. Those are the areas that we really should spend more time getting better at.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, or I think you know, but our podcast listeners who don't know, I'll tell you how to figure that out quickly is to ask the people around you, just to be super direct and say, where do I add the most value? And what do you wish I wouldn't do? And what meetings do you wish I would not attend? And as the boss, of course, you know, everybody laughs at my jokes. And if I want to talk about something, nobody interrupts me, right? But if I'm not self-aware enough to know where I add value and where I don't, I can actually slow the decision-making process down. And one of the things I've tried to get in the habit of doing with all my direct reports at the end of any meeting is, okay, what do you need from me? What do you need from me? I don't want my unwillingness to commit to a decision or my insensitivity to the fact that a decision needs to be made to hold back what needs to be done. So just ask. Everybody knows what you're not good at. When I reach to take, and I don't do this anymore, but when I used to say, hey, let me handle some sort of event planning or I'll take care of that, everybody reached for it real quick. Said, no, we got it. Because number one, I'm not great at it. Number two, it takes me too long. So those things, you know, you can learn over time the hard way or you can just ask.
That's good. I've heard you say this numerous times that decision-making, one of the challenges of it is that it is so emotional. Our emotions are always affecting the way we make decisions and the decisions that we make. And you talk about that a lot in this book. You talk about selling yourself and your decisions. What's the trap there when we sell ourselves?
Yeah, in the book, I talk about the fact that we all have an internal salesperson or sales associate that's constantly trying to sell us basically on things we've already decided we want, but we're rational human beings or we think we are. So just wanting something's not enough. I need to need it. So my brain comes up with a reason I need this or we need to do that. So consequently, we can't really trust in most cases that internal salesperson and we all have one. We all have one. Mine, his voice sounds a lot like my voice, right? And yours probably sounds a lot like your voice. The prophet Jeremiah summed it up. This is harsh. He said, hey, our hearts are deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? And we're all like, I don't know. I don't understand why I did what I did. What was I thinking? Well, I wasn't thinking. I was selling. So part of mastering, if you can master it, the process of decision-making is to differentiate between objective truth or facts or things that need to be brought into the process and that person inside of our heads that is constantly trying to sell us. And in the book, one of the things I say is, hey, you rarely have to sell yourself on a good idea. So when you catch yourself selling yourself, you need to hit pause. Mm. Because when it comes to the right thing, when it comes to good things, we don't have to sell ourselves. We generally know. But we've all got that sales associate living in our heads, constantly appealing to my ego, to my insecurity, and to my fear, and leveraging all that to sell me oftentimes on what really are bad ideas. So when you start selling yourself, you've just got to hit pause. And you know, the other interesting thing about this, Clay, and this is a little bit off topic, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, not much, is that if I was in a retail store and the sales associate said to me the kinds of things the sales associate in my head says to me, I would be so offended by that person, I would walk out of the store, right? Wow. Well, Andy, I see you already have one, but this one's newer. Mm-hmm. Is that a sales pitch? That's mm-hmm. ridiculous. What else you got? But that's all
this,
I need
this
sometimes.
Will make you look younger.
This will, yes, yes. This will make you look.
You can't say that to me.
No, exactly. You would just be offended. Or if you get home and decide you don't want it, you can always donate it. Well, yeah. I mean, think of the things we say to ourselves that if someone were to say to us, or worse than that, well, you know, your husband or your wife, she will never know. He will never know. You know, they're not really all that sharp. Wow. It's like, wait, you're talking about my husband. You're talking about my wife, right? But again, this internal conversation we have, I think ferreting some of that out, teasing it out, recognizing it for what it is, and trying as hard as we can not to be swayed by that. That is part of it. But that, you know, that's a little bit of maturity and objectivity. And again, it comes back to, are we listening? Are we listening? Are we listening? Because if I'm only listening to the person in the mirror, there's already a lid on my leadership and a lid on just how far I'm going to be able to lead myself, much less an organization.
So there are other things that you talk about that sabotage our decision-making. Can you give us a few others?
Gosh, yeah. We're all familiar with confirmation bias. We all just absorb the things that confirm what we already want to do. That's just a reality for all of us. Again, being surrounded by the wrong people. If you know, leaders who refuse to listen will eventually be surrounded by people who have nothing helpful to say. We've talked about that before. Again, who we are surrounded by and our willingness to check our ego at the door and listen. You know, all those things oftentimes get in the way. So to our podcast listeners, I haven't said anything you didn't already know and you haven't already heard before, probably. But the discipline of bringing those things front and center and recognizing them and acknowledging them, that's what we have to do in order to gain the objectivity we need to make sure, not that we're making all the right decisions, but the right decisions are being made. And then we have the humility to give credit to the people who were, you know, behind some of those extraordinary decisions, and then also the humility to own the bad decisions, even though we didn't make them, because ultimately we are responsible for them. And that give and take is, you know, probably another topic for another day.
Well, in the book, you give us 5 questions that really creates a decision-making filter or a grid that we can run everything through. I'd love to spend the rest of our time allowing you to walk us through these 5 questions.
Sure.
The first one, you call it the integrity question.
Yep. And we've talked about this before. The integrity question is, am I being honest with myself? Am I being honest with myself? This is the self-leadership question. And of course, Clay, as you and I have talked about before, you know, the most difficult person to lead is the person in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're lying to ourselves, not only can we not lead ourselves well, we can't lead the people around us well either. We will end up lying to them. So am I being honest with myself? As I'm considering an option, as I'm pushing on an option, as I'm about to make the presentation, okay, am I being honest with myself? And then I add the word really, because it is so easy to deceive ourselves. Am I being honest with myself really? So again, the first question, whenever you're making any kind of big decision personally, relationally, but certainly organizationally, am I being honest with myself really? Why am I suggesting this really? Why am I pushing so hard on this really? Why am I refusing to give in to what 4 other people in the room think we should do really? What's really, really, really going on in my head, in my heart? Am I being honest with myself, really? That's the integrity question.
So a few years ago, we had a guy that we respect a lot, a leader, came and spoke at an event that we had for our staff, and he paid you a really great compliment. He said, the more you've gained popularity, the more followers you've gained, the more your organization has grown, you haven't taken the crazy pills, which I thought was,
yeah,
that was pretty funny. I mean, yeah. But there's something really profound there that he's saying, that the more power you get, the more
right.
notoriety you get, the more fame you get, typically we allow ourselves to start making worse decisions. But what would you say to someone on how to stay, even as your career grows and as your influence grows, how do you stay ruthlessly honest with yourself?
That's a really important question that we could probably spend an entire podcast on. So my short answer to that is I have maintained friendships with people who were my friends before they were associates, employees. They are not impressed. My sister-in-law, she is not impressed. My sister-in-law actually works for us now. She's still not impressed. And I mean that in a very positive sense. Mm-hmm. So by nature of relationships, I have stayed accessible to people who are just not going to take any crap off of me. And I'm not even really tempted to think more of myself than I should. And that really isn't a statement of how humble I am. Again, both of us have seen so many leaders in business and outside of business fail and fall mm-hmm. because of ego, because of who they're surrounded by and who they're not surrounded by. And it always begins, it seems, with isolation. Not isolation like there's no one around, isolation in that they always have the wrong people mm-hmm. around. And I hope there are people close enough to me that if they saw me drifting in that direction, would call me on it. Mm. Well, you know, several of the folks I've worked with over 25 years, mm. they would call me on it. They were friends before we were associates in this organization. And for many of our podcast listeners, that is not helpful information because you either have that or you don't. Mm. And if you don't, you can't rewind time and create that. But in terms of what I think has been most helpful to me personally, it has been that. And then the other thing, and again, this is not all that helpful either, but it's true for me personally. I grew up with a father who was famous within the context of his industry or his business as a nonprofit leader and as a pastor. And you could just sniff out the sycophants. You just saw it coming a mile off and you saw how easy it is to be susceptible to the flattery and the invitations and even the flirtation. And I think that has helped me create maybe another extra layer of emotional safeguards and physical boundaries because I saw that. So again, for me, I think I've had the advantage of those two things, but there are artificial ways to create those and every leader has to take steps. If you're swept along by the current of your popularity, eventually there will be consequences as well as benefits, but there are consequences to that.
Well, you say it might not be helpful to people that don't have it. I'll tell you, to people that currently do have it, the helpful part is to maintain that. Because
yeah.
hopefully as you grow in your career and your influence grows and your opportunities grows, mm-hmm. to know that the temptation is going to be there to kick those people out
yep.
or to shut them out yep. when they disagree with something or when they bring up something difficult, when that happens to you instead, those are the kinds of people that you probably want to keep close.
Yeah, and this goes back to this question, am I being honest with myself? Why am I pushing those people out of my inner circle? Mm. Really? Mm. Now, and I know what you told your wife. I know what you told your husband. I know what you said to the board, but come on. Why are you pushing them? Why are you pushing him? Why are you pushing her out of your inner circle? Really? It really comes back to that internal, one-on-one with the person in the mirror integrity. Mm. And you've heard this. There are some famous leaders, one in particular, who says this often, who you start with is not going to be who you finish with, meaning the team that you begin with probably won't be the team you end with, which means along the way, the people who knew you as the founder or who knew you when you first had this idea, right. they're not going to be there when there's all the popularity and all the rewards of success that have the potential to sweep a person beyond their guardrails. They're not there because they either couldn't keep up, didn't keep up, or for whatever reason, they're just not there. And again, I feel fortunate that I'm still working with some of the people that, we started this particular venture with over 25 years ago. That really, really helps.
Well, that's the integrity question. Let's talk about the legacy question.
Yeah, the legacy question. I love this question, especially for my children. The legacy question is, what story do I want to tell? What story do I want to tell? When this incident, when this opportunity, when this startup, when this round of choosing board members, whatever it is, when this is nothing but a story I tell, because every single decision and every single season of decision-making is eventually in the rearview mirror, and it's just a story we tell. Mm. So when this is nothing more than a story I tell, what story do I want to tell? And I call this the legacy question because we write the story of our lives, which is our legacy, one decision at a time. And we determine our legacy one decision at a time. Even our responses and reactions to things we have no control over are still decisions that we make. So what story do I want to tell? And where this is particularly helpful is when we're in a situation where we are justified in doing something that will hurt another person, justified in defending ourselves, justified in taking what is ours, justified in criticizing a person. You know, it's those moments in time when we're justified, but then we say, wait, okay. A year from now, 2 years from now, what story do I want to tell? I think I'd rather tell the story that I just kept my mouth shut. I think I'd rather tell the story that I just forgave her. I think I want to tell the story that I went ahead and gave back more than I really owed, but that's the story I want to tell. So it gains some perspective. And again, every season of life, the example I use sometimes is, hey, you ask an adult about high school, think about it. We reduce 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades to about two sentences. It's like, I mean, in the moment, you know, it's daily, it's emotional. But so every season of life, every season of decision-making, every round of decision-making becomes a story we tell. And we get to decide what story we tell if in the moment we can stop and say, okay, before I decide, before I pull the trigger on this, when this is nothing more than a story I tell, what story do I want to tell? And again, in walking my children through some relational challenges, even some school issue challenges, I'm telling you, this question will stop you in your tracks. Mm. And suddenly, what wasn't an option becomes an option, because at the end of the day, we all want to be the hero in our own stories. Mm-hmm. And the hero is the one that forgives, and the hero is the one that goes the second mile, and the hero is the one that doesn't, you know, rub it in their face and take everything that's on the table. And when we have the perspective of, hey, what story do I want to tell? Suddenly, options that weren't really options become live options. So that's the second question.
The place I see this showing up a lot at work for, and I think this would apply for every single person listening today, is the job we're in right now is probably not the last job we'll ever have.
Yeah.
And it's during those transitions that it's so easy to slip out without making everything right, or to badmouth somebody on your way out, or to not... to go back to the first question, to not be as honest as we really should be, even with ourselves. That's a real common area, wouldn't you say?
That
summing up that whole season of your life with, that's going to be part of your story someday, and you get to decide how did you leave?
And you get to decide how, when you tell your children this story,
right,
or your grandkids, or when this story is told about you, you want to be the hero. Yeah. And that's not an arrogant thing. That's generally the hero of the story is the one that does the most for other people. So, absolutely. Those transitions are emotional. I mean, transitions are always emotional, even the good ones. I mean, taking your kids to school for the first time, first grade, it's emotional. It's a transition. So transitions are always emotional. And it's in those transitions we are least likely to think in terms of story and to think in terms of a decision. Mm. But it's one day, this is just going to be a story that you tell. What story do you want to tell?
So the third big question in this decision-making filter is the conscience question.
Yep. The conscience question is there a tension that deserves my attention? Is there a tension that deserves my attention? And the best way to explain this one is to throw out a scenario we've all experienced. You're about to make a decision. Everything in the left column looks good. Everybody does it this way. It's an industry standard. You know, it makes sense financially, just, you know, it just all makes sense. And then as you get close to signing the deal or pulling the trigger or making the call or calling her back, you know, whatever it might be, there's just something on the inside that just causes you to hesitate. And it is 100% irrational. If it was rational, it would be in that other column where you're doing the pros and cons.
Right.
But there's just an internal hesitation. And when we experience that, we should pay attention to that tension. Don't brush by it. Don't rush by it. Don't try to ignore it. The way I say it is, let it bother you until it either goes away or you discover why it bothers you.
Wow.
And what all of us have experienced at some level is when we have paused, and generally we don't, when we have paused long enough, either new information or insight surfaces, or we discover something on the other side of the page that looked like it was all buttoned up, wasn't really all that buttoned up. And there's just an intuition. My dad used to call it checking his spirit. You know, a lot of people call it a red flag. He was, I have a check in my spirit about that. And as a kid, I'm like, okay, what is that? Just, you know, why? Because as a kid, I'm like, tell me why I can't go. Tell me why this isn't a good idea. Well, I'm not sure. I just have a check in my spirit. I'm like, well, how do you argue with that? Right. Well, you can't. But, you know, he was always right. Later down the road, you discover, oh yeah, that he wasn't such a great friend, was he? You know, anyway, so is there attention that deserves my attention? Just pause and, you know, if there's something about her that bothers you, let it bother you. If there's something about him that bothers you in a corporate environment, this shows up in the interview process. Yep. Everything looks great on the resume. All the questions were answered correctly. And you walk out of the interview and you can't put your finger on it. And because we think we're rational and because we want to come across as people who make decisions based on facts and not emotion, the temptation is to ignore that thing in our gut. And it's almost always a mistake to ignore that. So is there a tension that deserves my attention? Whenever you're making a big decision, pay attention to that tension.
I'm glad you brought up hiring because that was the place where I was thinking about this question, context, because we've all been there where you look at the resume and you think it all adds up. Yeah. It's the left column.
Plus, we're in a hurry, right?
And we need the job to get done. Exactly. But when we've all learned this, anybody who's been in a position of hiring, you have experienced this. I mean, 4 times out of 5, if there is a check in your spirit and you think, I don't even know how to put this, I don't even know what to say, but there's something that's making me pause, the best decision would have been to just not hire.
Yep. And it's not fair.
Right.
But it's still the right decision.
And it might not even be explainable. No. It might not be explainable to the team or to other people. But I've just learned more times than not, it's better to just go slow.
Yep.
It's better to just say, you know what, we're going to keep looking.
Yep.
Because making a hire that you kind of knew wasn't the right hire usually ends up in a regret.
Yep. The other area, flipping, going back to the more personal side of this that many of you in our podcast audience can perhaps identify with, and if you haven't yet, I promise you, you will if you're a parent. You'll meet some of your kids' friends, and you hate to be judgmental, and it's really not about being judgmental because your responsibility as a parent is to protect your children, number one. And you will never, ever be able to explain to your son or daughter why you just don't think that's a relationship they should pursue. The moment you try to put it into words, you've created a target for a conversation that you will lose because you just don't have enough information yet. But as a parent, we have to trust our gut. And again, it's not fair to our kids' friends, but in terms of protecting our kids, which is our responsibility, it's just there. We all have that thing, whatever that thing is. As a Christian, I think I know what it is. For materialists and people who are naturalists, they have another explanation, but nobody can deny it's there. So is there attention that deserves my attention?
That's really good for me because I struggle with saying no as a parent. My wife is so much better at that. And so if I have that check, I'll usually go, well, I don't know what I should do about it. And she'll always say to me, be the parent. That's what you should do is be the parent.
Don't be rational.
Be the parent. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, you don't have the luxury of principles.
No.
Just be the parent.
That's right. Yeah. And that leads us into our fourth question, because sometimes you feel that tension and you think, well, I'm not sure I know what to do now about it.
Yeah.
And that brings us to this great question that you call the maturity question.
Yeah. This is a question that I was raised on with my dad, and I have taught so many times that, again, anybody who's heard me teach through the years, I come back to this over and over. The maturity question is, what is the wise thing to do? Not what is the right thing, not what is the legal thing, not what is the ethical thing, the moral thing. This steps way back from those lines. You can go to jail if you cross some of those lines, right? What is the wise thing to do? And, you know, the best way to ask this question is to tease it out into 3 dimensions. In light of my past experiences, what's the wise thing for me to do? Maybe not everybody else. Everybody else can go. But in light of my past experience, I have no business going there. In light of my current circumstances, in light of what's going on right now, you know, and I just get out of a relationship. This isn't the wise thing for me to do. This isn't the time right now in light of my current circumstances. And then in light of my future hopes and dreams, what is the wise thing for me to do? And this is a question that has three corporate components as well, in light of our past, in light of what's happened in the past organizationally, in light of what's going on right now organizationally, in light of what we want to see happen in the future organizationally. What is the wise thing for us to do? And our worst decisions, or I should say our greatest regrets, either corporately or personally, are generally preceded not by a series of illegal decisions or immoral decisions or unethical decisions. Generally, our greatest regrets, that moment in time we wish we could go back and just undo that 5 minutes or that one weekend or that one deal, I wish I could just take the ink off the paper. Those decisions are generally preceded by a series of unwise decisions. So if we begin to draw the line at what is the wise thing to do, it protects us. It keeps us back from the edge of disaster. And in a sense, this is it's the maturity question, because it takes a lot of maturity to step back from the line of immoral, illegal, or unethical. Our tendency, our natural tendency, is to snuggle right up to the line with no margin for error. And then we wonder, you know, why we got in trouble so quickly. So what is the wise thing to do?
The area that I wanted to ask you about, Andy, that I would imagine there's a lot of people probably right now facing a question like this, is as they're looking, as they're evaluating or weighing, should they take this promotion or should they take this job that might require them to move to a different city? Mm-hmm. Or if they took on this new responsibility at work, it might mean that they've got to stay later. Or they've got to
travel more.
Yeah. Exactly. What do you say to that person who's weighing a decision like that?
I'm glad you brought that up. Because there is, in each season of life, there are different freedoms and margins for what we do with our time, and they change. For example, you are in the busiest season of life right now with 5 kids at home, young children at home. So the way Sandra and I used to manage this, and this is where, you know, work and family collide, was we just came up with a list of things, and we said no for now, but not forever. No for now, but not forever. These are not bad things, and these aren't things we won't ever do. These are things we're not going to do in this season. So
they're unwise right now.
For us, yeah, it would be unwise to engage with certain activities, to take on certain travel, to say yes to certain opportunities. They're not wrong. I hope they come back someday. So no for now, but not forever. And that ongoing tension, it never ends. That ongoing tension between work and family, and how do you prioritize one over the other, and how do you succeed at both? Oftentimes comes down to this decision in light of our past experience, in light of our current circumstances as a family, in light of our future hopes and dreams, in light of our future hopes and dreams as it relates to our relationship with our children. What is the wise thing for me to do as it relates to this promotion or this move? So what is the wise thing to do?
Why is it such a better idea? That list that you talked about making, that's a great concept. There's probably a lot of people listening going, oh my goodness.
No for now, but not forever. No, we had it. And now we're empty nesters. We do everything. We're making up for, I still don't play golf, but other than that, we're doing all that stuff.
Why is it so much better? Why is it so much more helpful to make that list even when the opportunity is not right there in front of you?
You mean to take some categories just off the table to begin with?
Exactly.
Yeah. Because otherwise, we play it week to week, day to day, month to month, instead of just categorically no. And so that's what we did. We said categorically, this is a no. And I would say to Diane Grant, my administrative assistant, Diane, when these opportunities come along, you can just go ahead and say no. Be polite, but don't say, what about this one? And this one's on a Tuesday and you don't have anything on Wednesday. No, let's don't play that game. This is just a categorical no. And the same for Sandra as it related to things that lots of young moms were running around and getting involved in. It was just a categorical no. And again, it's a wisdom decision, because I'm not standing at the edge of potential robbing my kids of my time and having to make a decision every week. Here it comes again. Here it comes again. It's just a categorical no for now, but not forever. And when we talk about this with parents, they always want to know what our list is, and we won't give them our list because that was our list.
Come on, Andy, give us the list.
That's our list. And it's, in some ways, it's job specific, industry specific, season of life specific. It can be specific to what part of the country you live in, but going through that exercise is powerful, and it is a wisdom exercise, because these aren't right or wrong things. Mm-hmm. These are just no for now, but not forever.
I love that. The last question is the relationship question. Can you talk us through that one?
Yeah. The relationship question is different than the other four. There is an ROI on the other four. There is a return on investment. If you make the wise decision, if you write a story you're proud to tell and you ask, what story do I want to tell? If you're honest with yourself when you're looking in the mirror, if you're paying attention to the tension, you will make better decisions that benefit you, period. You just will. You will live with fewer regrets. The relationship question is different because the relationship question will cost you something and there may be no return. In fact, the nature of the question assures that you can't hold out for a return because it's contrary to the nature of the question. And the relationship question is designed really for both parties to ask. But the reason there's no necessary return is you can't make another person ask this question. Mm. The relationship question is, what does love require of me? What does love require of me? When I'm not sure what to say or do, just do what love requires of you, which sounds soft and mushy, and we all think it's Valentine's Day, but this has nothing to do with any of that. This is a sacrificial type of love because real love always requires something of us. Dropping back into organizational life, your love for your company is going to require something for you. Your love for the people that you're surrounded with and hired and want to see succeed, it's going to require something of you. This is the question that brings me to the brink of, am I willing to do something for others that costs me and there's no return on the decision? And the people we have the most respect for, the people we want to grow up and be like, specifically, the people we want our children to marry are the people who live this way. They are the others first kinds of people. And in organizational life, especially as we get more and more responsibility and everybody laughs at our jokes and we have, you know, more and more success, there is less and less expectation to live this way. The expectation is that other people are going to live this way toward us. So it is even more incumbent upon me at this season of my life, as I think about the people I work with and the people I serve, okay, I know what I think I deserve. I know what I think I'm entitled to. And entitlement runs diametrically opposed to this question. Not what am I entitled to? That's the question we intuitively ask. What does love require of me? And when both parties, when both people are willing to ask that question, there is no relational gap that can't be closed. I don't think there are many relational problems that couldn't be solved. But that's what makes this a risky question. There is no guaranteed return, but it is a question worth asking because as a Christian, it's this question in a sense that changed the world. Mm. And it has the potential to change a culture and a community. And it has the potential to perhaps change the culture within your organization. What does love require of me?
Andy, there's a lot of people listening to this that are thinking, okay, that might work in a church context. Yeah. That does not work in
right.
my office.
Right.
That doesn't work in right. the corporate world. It doesn't work on my sales job. It sometimes doesn't even work at school or on my team or in higher ed. What would you say to that person who is just maybe not negatively dismissive, but they're just dismissive of it because they think that's not the world that I'm in?
Yeah, well, they're wrong. And here's how they know they're wrong. You know, if you can set your ego aside for just a minute, who are you most loyal to? The most selfish people you know? Are you drawn to the people who are just in it to win it for themselves? Mm. No. And if you're surrounded by those kinds of people, you don't just have a personal problem. You have an organizational problem. You have everybody Wow. who's in it to win it for themselves. The only way to create synergy in terms of a group of people who have come together to accomplish something great, when that happens, everybody has to lay something down. Everybody has to give up some personal freedom. Everybody has to give up some entitlement. And this is not a leadership principle, and it's not a ploy, and it's not just lead by example. People see through that. Mm-hmm. This is a genuine, I'm going to take a chance, and I, as the leader, I'm going to go first, and I'm going to do what's best for you. And I'm going to give you the opportunity to reciprocate. And the mature people will reciprocate. And when they do, you have a culture that can accomplish just about anything and solve just about anything. And the other reason we know that's not true is when we look at companies and organizations or nonprofits or churches that implode, they never implode in spite of how great everyone's character was and in spite of how selfless everybody was. It's just the opposite. The culture implodes because everybody was in it to win it for themselves and they were unwilling to put themselves out there and say, you know what, I'm going to do what's best for you, regardless of whether or not that comes back to me. So when you lead this way, you don't necessarily attract more competent people, but you will attract people with greater character. So you do your homework and you make sure you hire competent people who can do the job. Mm-hmm. And then you create a culture that's, hey, I'm for you, even if it doesn't come back to me. and you just never close your hand and you never rescind that offer. And when you do that, you create a culture that attracts healthy people, and you create a culture that unhealthy people are not comfortable in, and they stick out like a sore thumb in a minute, even if you've made a bad hiring decision.
So I've got a challenge to anybody listening that feels like, I don't know that that would work. I think you ought to double down on that one and put it on the wall.
Yeah.
Put that question on the wall of your office.
What does love require of me?
I mean, just imagine the way that would change your team dynamic, your company dynamic. I think it would really, it would create a new standard of the kinds of relationships that we're really trying to develop in our organization.
And just to push on that a little bit, I'm glad you said that. This is not soft. Sometimes what love requires of me is confrontation. And if I'm not a confronter, that is so uncomfortable.
Wow.
But love requires me to be uncomfortable to confront somebody for the sake of the organization and for the sake of them personally. So this isn't soft and mushy and there's soft music playing in the background. Not at all. In fact, as a Christian, the ultimate demonstration of this was not Jesus feeding 5,000 people. Mm-mm. Wouldn't that be nice? The ultimate demonstration of this is Jesus allowing himself to be arrested and crucified. Mm. He put on a demonstration of love that took his breath away. And we're still talking about it 2,000 years later. So it's not soft. It's going to be experienced and asked through our different personalities and our different temperaments. But at the end of the day, it's how can I put you first, even if it costs me?
I feel like I would have a regret myself, Andy, if I didn't ask you this last question. When you set out to write this book, I would imagine it was before 2020. So you didn't know a pandemic was coming. You didn't know all the racial tension in America was coming. You didn't know all that was going to happen in 2020. But as you think back on that year, it has certainly amplified the need for great decision-making. Any thoughts on that?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that all five of these questions were as relevant in 2020 as they were in 2019 when I first had the idea of taking these questions. I've really asked throughout most of my life and packaging them as a book. The applications and the expressions of these questions were certainly a little bit different, but really 2020 created the opportunity for these kinds of questions to really be amplified relationally and corporately and nationally. Mm. And so looking back on 2020, imagine if political leaders on both sides had gotten up every morning, looked in the mirror and said, okay, I know what my party says. I know what I've always said. I know what I have built my reputation on. Am I being honest with myself? Really? What if they'd all gotten up and said, okay, at the end of my term or at the end of this difficult year, when I think about my participation as a leader, what story do I want to tell? When my kids, my grandkids are telling the story of how I navigated this, what story do I want to tell? And is there a tension that deserves my attention? And what is the wise thing to do? And what does love require of me? I mean, imagine leaders, even in the political arena where there's always going to be disagreement, there's always going to be tension. And I think that's one of the strengths of our republic is there is that tension. It should never go away. But these five questions create the oil and the machinery of the differences in those two parties or wherever there are two parties. If you think about a combustible engine, you know, the parts are made to work together, but without a lubricant, they destroy each other because of the friction. These five questions, when asked, answered honestly, and acted on, create the lubricant between the parts that are designed to work together so they work together well. So again, these are transgenerational. These five questions are important for family. They're important for business. They're important for all of us personally. I didn't make any of them up. I've just discovered them along the way. Yeah. Again, the way I was raised and just the experiences I've had as a leader and as a father and basically as a Jesus follower. So yeah, I think they're as relevant now as ever.
Well, thanks for putting the hard work in to make them simple, because they're memorable, they're simple, and they're certainly applicable. And no matter what industry you're in or no matter what field you're in, no matter what age you are, they really can help us all at any stage of life.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Clay, I just have to say you did a great job interviewing me. You set me up to talk about exactly what I wanted to talk about, which is what a great interviewer does.
My pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, and thanks so much for joining us on this month's podcast. I want to encourage you to visit andystanley.com, where you can download the Leadership Podcast application guide to go with today's content. And then you can also find a way to get my latest book, Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. If you're a parent or a grandparent, I'm telling you, These are five questions you'll want your kids and grandkids to ask for the rest of their lives. And as you've just discovered, these are five questions you can incorporate into your organizational leadership as well. Thanks for listening, and make sure you join us next month on the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast.